you're constantly to grow, you have to resist your commonality thoughts that you're comfortable with, you know, so you have to keep challenging yourself and challenging what you're doing and why am I approaching this and what's the reason behind all that, you know, and it makes you a better person, you know, because the only way to grow is to overcome those obstacles, you know. And so you have to...
This photography podcast is brought to you by Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. Here is your today's host, W. Scott Olsen, with another fascinating conversation.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast from Frames Magazine. My name is Scott Olsen, and today we are going to do something extraordinary. We are going to talk about two things that are both equally renowned and famous and profound. We're going to talk about David Brookover's photography, and we're going to talk about David Brookover's gallery. And of course, our guest is David Brookover, world-renowned photographer specializing in landscapes and in large format, really, really well-considered, mindful images, mostly recently of the American West. And we're going to talk about a brick-and-mortar gallery, something that seems to be almost counterintuitive with the way that our relationship with images is going these days. I am really, really looking forward to these conversations. David, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Great. Nice to meet you. Nice to talk to you with you right now. Yeah.
This is going to be a thrill. David, you have so many really cool stories on your journey, both as a gallerist and as a photographer. And I want to start with the photography side, because your entree into photography is just a cool story. And it's not, you know, kind of the usual one. You were born in Kansas. You grew up on a dairy farm till around fifth grade or so. But then when you got into college, when you got into, you know, being a young adult, you were heading towards alternative medicine. You were heading towards acupuncture. Tell me who you were back then. Tell me what you were chasing.
Oh boy, I was chasing a lot of crazy theories back then. I had been semi-studying with some American Indian medicine men. I was heavily into Carlos Castaneda stuff back in this early 70s, mid 70s, 80s. I ended up going to an acupuncture school in Maui.
Right.
I was there from 1983 through 86. It was a continuous 3-year course. I graduated from that, and I was getting ready to decide whether I wanted to stay in Maui or to go, you know, somewhere else. I was actually getting island fever a lot in Maui. You know, it's pretty there. But at that time, you know, that was the AIDS epidemic, and acupuncture and needles, you know, and everything. People were a bit leery about having acupuncture back then. But Japan had come across this technology called blue light laser acupuncture. And so I thought, wow, that's great. So I can actually go to Japan, study this, and then bring it back to the States. And this, you know, I'll have a captive market, you know, and no more needles or anything like that. So I ended up moving to Tokyo in 1986. And unfortunately, what happened was that my license that I had in America wouldn't transfer to Japan. And they said, you know, this is great, though. You could take the course if you can take the test to become an acupuncturist in Japan in kanji.
And I'm I was going to say.
I'm thinking, yeah, I know like 5 Japanese words. And you want me to say an acupuncture test? No, I can fly back to Maui and be practicing next week. I don't think so, you know. But anyway.
But you didn't. You stayed.
I stayed because, you know, I figured I've already spent $10,000 moving there. So I might as well, you know, just take a year off, you know, a little sabbatical, right? Mm-hmm. So I ended up, and I just fell in love with the country. And about about 2 years in, I remember I had a guarantor at that time whose daughter worked for this really, it was a top stock photography agency there in Japan. It was called Photonica. Mm-hmm. And he used to come up with these wonderful, wonderful catalogs, you know, and I thought, God, this is so nice. And so I showed her some of my work, and she said, well, you know, you could make some money at that, David, you know, it's just, get together about 350 strong images, you know, and bring them in. We'll look it over. And then we'll, you know, hopefully be able to, you know, get you a part of the corporation here, which I did. And it worked out. And so then I started doing stock photography along with I was doing transcribing and editing and
right.
teaching and everything like that, you know, because, you know, my visa at that time was a cultural visa. And then I worked into a working visa. So I could travel back and forth. And because I knew the states, then I could go to the Southwest and the West and all those places and be able to, you know, provide them with those type of images that maybe the Japanese didn't quite know where those areas were.
Okay, you skipped over a step there, though, because when you found out that, you know, you had to learn the language before you could take the licensure test for acupuncture,
yeah.
you could have gone into cooking, you could have gone into sports. I mean,
yeah.
there was 100 other things that were possible. But, you know, you have said online in a number of places that you were already, you know, really mesmerized by Japanese art and especially yeah. fabrics.
Yeah.
Why did the yeah. camera become the thing that latched onto you?
Well, see, I was just recording my time of that year that was there. So I was going to Kyoto and all these areas up in the northern area of Tohoku. And that's she saw some of that work. And she said, well, and you know, I had no idea you could make any money doing this, you know, stock photography. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about that. I had some British and American friends that had been there since the 70s and they were making a killing. So I thought, well, I'll toss my hat into it, right? See if this will work. You know, because there was certainly no visas being issued for photographers. You know, these guys were, you know, working for Newsweek and Time, or they had married a Japanese lady, so they could, you know, they were pretty much set up. But mm-hmm. I didn't have any of those things going. I wasn't being, you know, I wasn't working for Newsweek or, you know, it was just fascinating. You know, everything was happening so fast there in Japan. And so I just thought, well, you know, I'll just grab this bull by the horns and see how far it goes, you know. And so I showed the work, and then the agency said, well, you know, you don't have to have a visa to do stock photography because you're going to be traveling. As long as you're leaving the country every 3 months, you're pretty well off there as far as immigration status. So, you know, I would travel back and forth and back and forth, and it worked out. You know, really well. I mean, eventually I did it for many, many years. And I went from 35 to medium format to 4x5, briefly 4x5, and then eventually to 8x10. And by the time 8x10, that was many years later. Well, then the stock agencies were saying, like, we don't need 8x10 work. That's too expensive to scan, you know, and put into
yeah.
the work. But that was when what happened, and with Fujifilm, I was able to start working for them in the international department, you know, as far as taking new film emulsions like mm-hmm. Provia and Astia and those type of films, and you know, and then shooting in the West for ad campaigns in Japan. So, which was an interesting note. I don't know if you know this, but Provia was actually the first film that was introduced abroad rather than in Japan. They'd always introduced in Japan first and then
right.
send it abroad.
Yep.
So we had a massive project one time. It was about a half a year. It was 5.5 months where we traveled in the States just shooting. I mean, it was great. It was all free film. I was carrying about $10,000 worth of film. Or I had Velvia, maybe about the fourth or fifth generation of Velvia. And then I had the first generation of Provia. It was mm-hmm. it was pretty much a mismatch, you know. But but they tried, you know. And then we got the generation 2 on the Provia, and then generation 3, you know, which was, you know, much, much better film. But those are fun times. I have to admit, they're a lot of traveling. My God, we drove 24,000 miles in that 6 months period.
Oh, that sounds like heaven.
Yeah,
I would love to do that.
Yeah.
Let me go back just one step, because I mean, there's a theme, you know, as I look at your history, as I look at your resume, there's a kind of theme going here. You're starting off with alternative medicine. You get into
yeah.
Japanese art and fabrics and stuff. And then you're coming back and you say you start with 35.
Yeah.
I love the line, you know, the line you said you got a 4x5, then got rid of it right away.
Yeah.
You know,
it wasn't big enough.
Okay, but it's You talk in another part on one of your blogs, there's a marvelous quote, and I forget who it's by now, where you say photography is a resistance to the way that things are. Instead of, I love that term, not a celebration, not a documentation, not, you know, a love song. It's a resistance to the way things are. Is that sort of a base chord in your life? Because you seem to be going for things that are just slightly deeper, slightly more profound, slightly less easy at every step of the way.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, with this change in environment now from analog to digital and everything you can do, It's this resist. You know, it's kind of a, in some ways, on another level, it's a resistance to wanting to learn this. Also, you're constantly to grow. You have to resist your commonality thoughts that you're comfortable with. You know, so you have to keep challenging yourself and challenging what you're doing and why am I approaching this and what's the reason behind all that. You know. And it makes you a better person, you know, because the only way to grow is to overcome those obstacles, you know, and so you have to do that, which are unto themselves, you know, resistatory measures. So, yeah.
Cool. Yeah. You say that you use photography as a way to understand new places and cultures. What do you mean?
Well, new cultures, you have to break through. You have to embrace them.
Mm-hmm.
Have to, again, on emotional levels, obviously, how you see that culture, how you see nature, how you see new trends, everything like that. I definitely use photography because it forces me to immerse myself into that culture or that scenery.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's always been my route. You know, a musician can obviously write a song about something, you know, and try and explain it metaphorically that way. But I have to try and do it visually through capturing that imaging and then to show it in a certain way that allows me to embrace that culture too, you know, which is kind of funny because I'm getting ready to go back to Japan for a couple months. I really want to do it well in black and white, but mm-hmm. I'm a little nervous because it's so comfortable to do it in color in the fall. And I'm going, oh my God, how can I do this? Because I know that I'm going to do it in black and white, but dang, I mean, when you see Kyoto and, you know, Northern Japan and just the absolute sheer beauty, which is unparalleled of any place I've ever been in the world. And then you're thinking like, okay, but I want to show something that's, you know, the more historical side, which I view it through as black and white, but mm-hmm. you have everything you can do with it in color, but it's like, oh, gotta make this work, you know, gotta make this work. You know? And I'm already planning this right now going, okay, mm-hmm. it's going to work. Cause sometimes you just can't translate the color comfortably into black and white. And I haven't seen too many people who could do it really well. I mean, a few people, but mm-hmm. it's without, you know, introducing a certain grit factor or something like Dido or someone like that. But I would, it's going to be an interesting challenge, but it's going to be fun too. So, yeah.
Are you a massive planner? Because I, you know, again, yeah. you know, reading your chart. Okay.
I overplan. I really do. I overplan. And then when I get there, I toss it all away and I go, well, yeah, it's just the way it is. You know, it's like everything I thought I was going to shoot or plan to shoot. It's like, I just, no, it's not going to happen. You know, so, yeah.
Do you plan composition?
Oh, I usually know where to go. But when I'm there, then I go, no, I don't. And I think this is a shot that maybe I had seen. But, you know, I think I'm going to go this other, you know, maybe a different way. Because, you know, I do a lot of stuff nowadays. Digitally, where I will stitch together some images.
Mm-hmm.
So there, you're already starting at square one, you know, because you traditionally people will just take that one shot and that's it. And I'm looking at it going, God, but I think it'd be a little bit better wider or something like that, you know. And then you know, you can't really replicate or anything like that. So yeah, that's something I need to get over, but I still love doing it.
I don't know if you need to get over that at all, man. The reason I ask, you have a video on your website where you're out in the field with someone and you've got your little spotlight meter. And you didn't plan the composition, you know, 3 weeks in advance in your living room.
No,
boy, on site, there's no such thing as a quick snap going on right there.
Yeah, that was with the 8x10. Yeah.
There's a bunch of stories I want to hear, but tell me the story, just the average story of you got your tripod set, you got your camera mounted. Yeah. Okay. How long until, you know, you press the cord and take the image?
Okay. Are we shooting analog or digital?
Analog.
Okay. So analog. Well, first I have to raise my fist to the air and say, hey, would you just give me a break up, man? These bellows are vibrant. My wife used to, God bless her soul, we'd be down in the Southwest, you know, and you have this great shot, you know, somewhere in Monument Valley or something. You're just going, no, it's got to be slow. I need no wind because I need at least a half a second or a second, probably 5 seconds. I'd be thrusting my right arm in the wind, you know, like,
yep.
Give me a break here, you know, which just would drive me crazy. So, you know, there's a reason why guys with 8x10 shoot early in the morning. You know, it's one of the reasons, you know, because you're trying to get, if there's any flowers or anything up here, you know, you're trying to get like, you know, let's just have this perfect, you know, you're so anal about getting everything perfect, you know, which, you know, again, getting back to resistance, I started to build a resistance and a resentment to that type of photography because it just was so methodical. You know, I'm just sitting here looking at this going, God, I could do so many other things if I was, you know, shooting another way. But if you're wanting the quality at that time back then, you know, you would shoot 8x10 because that's what, you know, it sets you apart from everybody else. You know, but, you know, there from the time to set up, then I'm waiting, obviously, until the light is just perfect because those sheets of film were very expensive, you know, back in the days. And so I would just sit and wait and wait and wait. And sometimes you'd go, well, it might be a little bit better a minute from now. And then you realize, oh, that was the best part. And then you go home, you go, I didn't get anything, you know, back out tomorrow or something like that. So, and that's the beauty about digital now, because you can, with these higher resolution, you can take more chances, you know,
right.
It is so freeing, you know, you just take more chances but then it gets to be, you know, Scott, it gets to be a little bit too simple. So then you have to start modifying the way you shoot just to make it more interesting. So thus you start doing stitches and things like that, which really introduces all sorts of variables and problems because of clouds moving and everything like that too. So, but I seem to be out there way too long.
Okay.
Trying to get that shot. And then I get back and, you know, I used to look at it early years and you'd go, well, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. And then you realize it really wasn't that good. You look at it 2 or 3 years later and you go, yeah, it really wasn't that good. Now it's about a day later and I go, just dump them. You know, I just get rid of them. You go back in, dump them again. You go back, you might get a few. I really got lucky the other day. Got a new image that's going to be coming out. It's called Alberta Winds. And I was actually up trying to photograph the bears, which were out, but they weren't out that particular day. And there was so much smoke here in Jackson. You could barely see the Tetons. And that might be normal in August, you know, when we get fires from California or in out west or BC.
Right.
But this year in May, you never have cloudy skies in Jackson, but these Alberta fires were just so prevalent that you really couldn't see the Tetons. So I'm driving back home around 8 o'clock at night, and I just, you know, I looked over at the Tetons like, oh, this is so weird, you know, like it's just, they still got snow on them, but then there's this haze and I could barely see them. This might would give it a try. I would have never pulled out an 8x10 camera for that shot. You know, I was just no way, but you know, I did. And I had my 102 megapixel camera. And the funny thing was I stuck around long enough with the sun going down. And because of the soot and everything that was in the atmosphere, I got these unbelievable streaking sunset rays, you know, which are just like, you know, sheer luck being there, you know, and just waiting around, you know. So again, it's, you have to put in the time, but you also have to know how to edit yourself, you know, and just, if it's good, it's good. If it isn't, just get rid of it. You know, I can't understand how people can have 200,000 images on their computer, you know. It's like, get rid of that shit, you know, come on. It's just,
You do have a story of hauling an 8x10, you know, out of your car to get streaking sunlights. I don't even know how to pronounce this. Epiphanius rays? Is that right?
Oh, Epiphanius rays. Yeah, that was in Jedediah Smith Grove outside of Crescent City. Yeah, I was coming back again after shooting, coming up the hillside there as you go up over the hill, Howland Road, I believe it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fortunately, those were so prevalent. And so I literally jumped out of the car, grabbed my Wisner with a, I think I had a 210 Schneider lens or something like that. And I threw that thing on as fast as I could. And then, of course, then you're shooting redwood trees. It's like, okay, I got to get, everything's got to be straight, you know. And I was really sweating it. And stopped down about F-32 and just prayed, like, this has got to work because I haven't got much time to work with it. You know, mm-hmm. It was really fast. And that came out. Yeah, I came out very lucky on that one. Yeah.
It's a gorgeous shot. I would love to have been the bird on the branch watching you get this all set up, though.
Oh, my God. It was so fast. I don't think I'd be that fast now. Yeah. Yeah, the pressure was on, but yeah, I got lucky because trust me, I've lost a lot of them when I tried to do it that fast. But I'm not good speed bit.
and for the, I mean, when you're shooting wildlife, you do shoot digital, you say. So yeah. you are not firmly committed to just one format or one style, depending on the situation, except to go big, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, 8x10, but, you know, these new digital cameras now are so amazing. I have a Fuji GFX 100, mm-hmm. and, you know, I've got prints in the gallery now that are, oh, my God, 40 by 50, 40, you know, some of them are almost 60 inches. The thing is, if you do silver gelatin prints, you really have to stop on the long end at 52 if you want to traditionally frame them with a, you know, really nice mats and glass, because your glass, your museum AR glass is going to go 40 by 60 inches. Your mats, are 40 by 60, unless you get into oversized mats. And so that's sort of the limiting factor, like on the long end, 52, on the high end, 32, because mm-hmm. again, glass being 40 by 60, allow yourself 4 inches of space around it. So that's, you know, with these newer cameras, they can do that so easy. I mean, it's not a problem at all. You know, these GFX or the Hasselblad or anything like that, it's just, that's a piece of cake. It's really easy. Yeah. That, you know, so I will do that often, you know, especially when there's, you know, the light's changing quickly or the clouds are, you know, really rolling through fast. Cause I just, you know, you can't, it's so spontaneous, you know, mm-hmm. with those. And the quality, oh my God, the quality is just fantastic on these new lenses.
It is.
Lenses. Oh my God. You know, it's just, and it's fun. And the thing is, I'll convert it all over because often what we do now, unless I'm shooting black and white negatives, you know, in the olden days, we would take the film, we'd convert it, you know, you're going to drum roll scan it, and then you're going to end up printing out a huge negative and doing a contact print, you know. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the platinum prints that we had on early on, we, all those were contact prints because you have to do that for platinum palladium. Because if you look at the old masters, they're 4x5 or 5x7 or 8x10, and that's it. Yeah. So, we had to always drum roll scan everything and then, you know, take them in and take them to the lab and put them under that UV light and watch them fry.
I would say that's not good for them.
No, not at all.
I really want to get into printing in just a second. Certainly want to get into the gallery in just a second. But there's two stories, you know, from doing mm-hmm. a little bit of research I want to hear you tell, simply because I was laughing out loud when I heard them. You're in Japan, you're setting up a shot, and this curly-haired guy keeps walking in front of your shot.
Oh, yeah.
to tell me that story.
Well, so it was, it's called Ichigo-san, yeah, 3-5, Ichigo-san, yeah. So 3-5 7-year-olds. And the kids will wear these beautiful little kimonos. And I was at Meiji-jing in Tokyo. And I probably, at that time, I probably had my Nikon F3, probably. Yeah, or maybe okay. F4. And my 880 to 200 zoom, you know, and I'm photographing, you know, these little kids walking by, and then this, yeah, the curly guy walks through, and I'm like, what the heck, you know, and he's got his Hasselblad, and he's kind of going along and all that. And we just had to laugh because, you know, us foreigners, we love that stuff. You know, the Japanese take it very serious. Everybody's got their suits on and everything. We're just shooting them because it's just so unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And it was Michael Kennan. And he's just totally oblivious to what's going on. He's just doing his thing, you know.
Did you know it was him?
No, not at the time. No. Yeah. But I had another friend of mine who was there who I had just met. And this was really funny because I was running around just trying it really quickly. And I remember for some reason, this guy, his name was Ken Straighten. And he was doing a lot of work for the Northwest Airlines magazines. He did a lot of great in-flight magazines. Yeah.
Yep.
Incredible photographer. And I remember I saw him, never really seen him before. And I had my 8200 and I was trying to do something. I said, here, would you hold this lens? And this great big burly guy, and I was running over to get something at a wide angle, and I came back about 20 minutes later, and he goes like, God, you're the most trusting soul. He's hand off a, you know, a fairly expensive lens to just take off running. He goes like, how can I just left so easy? But I said, yeah, dude, you've got a Leica. I don't think you need that lens.
There you go.
Yeah, like I always had like a couple of Leicas around his neck, you know, and I was laughing. I go, no, I think it's pretty safe with you. But that was a fun time, Michael. Yeah. And I remember seeing Michael's first shows. It was in Tokyo. It was a Ming Gallery, and it was beautiful work. A buddy of mine, Dave Wade, was also doing the in-flight magazines, and a wonderful photographer lives in Portland, Maine now. We went to see Michael's show there, and just spectacular work. Then fast forward a few years later, and one of my best friends in Japan, I'd met probably the first month or so, he took on Michael Kenna representation.
Hmm.
So that's when they started later on, started doing the books in Hokkaido. Yeah, his name was Hideyuki Taguchi. And Hideyuki's gone on to be this, I mean, incredibly famous art director. And but I knew him as when he was before he's married and went to his wedding and everything like that. Now he's doing all these, you know, great big museum installations in Tokyo with these huge department stores. And I mean, he's world renowned now.
Yeah,
and he's hanging out with Andy Summers from Police. You know, he represents him and. Mm-hmm. And all these other great photographers. I met Herb Ritz through him with Madonna. Well, Madonna I didn't meet, but Herb Ritz had a show at Parco. And that was an interesting time. I mean, just all of these wonderful people that he was representing there. And then recently, you know, Michael turned over the bulk of his work now to the French Ministry of Cultural Ministry, like that. So, Yeah. So that was kind of a relief for Hideyuki because, you know, keeping all that work and everything safe and, you know, in the right space and everything like that, that was a lot of work. But yeah.
Let's take just a quick break. We hope very much that you are enjoying today's episode. The very fact that you are listening to this podcast suggests that photography means a lot to you. And if that's the case, you might want to have a look at Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. We truly believe that excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit readframes.com to find out more about our publication. And now, back to today's conversation.
The other story, you are the only person who I think can say that you've been arrested by a temple security guard for not taking pictures.
And that was only practicing my camera. I had an 8x10. I remember I was...
Oh, so you had a big camera. When I read the story, I thought you had like a little SLR or something.
Oh, no. I had a huge Wisner 8x10 camera. And what I was trying to do was just learn like tilt, shift, swings and everything. And the word at that time, all my friends that shot 8x10 was like, you know, don't even take an image for at least 6 weeks to 2 months. Fred Picker used to say, like, yeah, you know, 6 months, nothing's going to be good. So I would diligently go around, look at the Torii gates, look at all the various temples, just go out there just to see the movements. And here comes this guy. I know, obviously, he probably served in World War II because he was pretty old then. And mm-hmm. he comes walking up and is like riding up his bicycle and it's like, oh, you know, pointing to the camera. And I go, yeah, it's just, I don't have any film. I'm just trying to explain it to him. He didn't understand a word I was saying. And so he takes me over to the head of the temple. And this guy was totally cool. He spoke English. And he goes, like, wow, what kind of camera is that? I go, oh, you know, in Japanese, you know, in English. Yeah. And this guy is standing there, you know, just like red in the face. And I'm kind of laughing. I'm like, yeah, what's with this guy? I was like, it's just a camera. It's on a tripod. He goes, oh, yeah, yeah. He kind of berated and scolded him a little bit. Like, oh, look, the guy doesn't have any film. He's just out here, you know, taking in the beauty of it all. And so he kind of brushed him off. The guy kind of, you know, stomped away. And we sat down and just chatted for the longest time because, like, show me the movements on this. And what's a tilt? What's a swing? What's a shift?
Yeah.
And
stuff.
And then he looked at it and he's like, oh my God, everything's upside down in reverse. Yeah. And so I thought I was going to end up like taking him out into the courtyard, but no, we didn't do that. But I did have one time I had another experience with he was the head of the Buddhist sect in Nikko. Dave Wade and I were actually out photographing up there, and this guy came along, and he was ahead of the sect. He gave me his business card, and we were going through all these big temples up by Nikko. And about 2 weeks later, I came up again, and he saw me. And these Buddhist monks are pretty hilarious. He goes, oh, come to my house over here. Let's go have a beer. And I thought, oh, this is great. I'm with a Buddhist, you know, the head of the sect, and we get to his house, and his wife comes out, and this guy, we're in his garden, nothing. Okay, this is a nice, another little Zen moment, you know. And he pours me a half a beer, and he pours himself a half a beer. And I said, okay, and then he pours the other half in grapefruit juice,
and I'm okay,
like, okay, and he goes, sour beer, it's really good. You know, I'm thinking, what a way to destroy this beer. But I took a few sips, you know, and I'm like, oh my God, this was so bad. But you know, what are you going to do? So I'm talking, and he's like, oh, yeah, ready for another one. He goes inside. I dump it on the poor plant,
yeah,
you know, underneath me. He comes back, goes, oh, you're finished. He pours me another one. I'm going, yep, oh, how am I going to get out of this, you know? So, yeah. Quite characters, these guys, you know. So I get scolded and I'm trying to get drunk on, yep, half grapefruit juice. And
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm glad you told me it was bad, because otherwise I would have gone out this afternoon to try that.
I tell you, anytime somebody talks about, you know, sour beer or yeah, you got to have it with fruit juice. Don't do it.
Don't do it. Okay.
So bad. Never.
You have said, you know, a couple of times now, and this is the next subject, sort of a hard turn here, you know, about how important the print is. And, you know, even going back to your love for you know, Japanese fabrics and textiles and stuff. You know, we're living in a culture where we print to Instagram, you know, where the, you know, the paper is for, you know, the people much younger than you and I, almost irrelevant.
Right.
And yet here you are, I mean, not only silver gelatin or platinum palladium, you're doing pure palladium, you're doing the silver. I mean, you're going full hog in terms of the artifact, that the print is a print itself. It is a physical piece of art, not a file, you know, in somebody else's head. And I loved also in one of your videos, you've got, you know, the guys that are doing printing with you, you know, talking how you can get, and I love this term, one guy said you can get 8 to 10 different performances out of a shot, depending on how it's printed, and what values you're going for. Exactly. So tell me sort of your philosophy and your commitment to the print, the physical thing in your hands or in the frame.
Okay. So
in 25 words or less.
Oh, no, this is 25 minutes. Okay, so just for starters.
Okay.
here's an analogy, and it's a funny thing. I'm totally stealing this analogy from. Do you know who Rick Beato is? Rick Beato?
No.
He's a musician, producer.
Okay.
And he's out of L.A. He's probably got about 5 million followers. Just Beato. He did an interview about 2 weeks ago with Nuno Bettencourt, you know, who's the group Extreme. And they have this very famous song now called Rise, okay? And this interview went for 2 hours. And so they're talking about, you know, auto-tune and all this other stuff that's going on and about live performances, you know, because Rise is all about live performances. And they said, yeah, so here's my analogy, okay? They're talking about the best way to see music, okay, is a live performance. So you buy the ticket. You know, when we were younger, we'd buy the ticket. You remember this?
Oh, yeah.
And then you'd hold on to it, and you're waiting like, you know, someone my generation, like Neil Young or Crosby, Stills, Nash is coming, you know, and you're so excited, or if you're lucky, Led Zeppelin. And then you go to this arena, you're surrounded by all these people who love this, and then you get to hear them live, you know, this, and the sound, the smells, everything that's going on in that concert. And then you come home, and if you're alone, then you have to explain that to everybody, all your friends, you know, and you never forget that moment. A lot of people hold on to those tickets, you know, and all that. And he says, that is why the young kids now are starting to make the turn back into real music instead of auto-tune to a certain degree, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Compared to the young kids who also sit around and they go, oh, well, group XYZ, you know, very popular now. They're playing. I think I'm just going to watch it live on my iPhone.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So the iPhone, obviously, and the download and the compression, that is the digital internet world. Okay. And here, you get to see the performance of everything that went into it. So you walk in, you see the print, how we like to have it here, the size. You get to see it in a beautiful frame. You get to see it, you know, like if there's any little imperfections or something like that, we've got it displayed for you. This is how you're going to keep it in your house for years and years and years. And also, we show various papers because different people, they haven't seen like what a platinum print looks like, what a photogravure looks like, what a bromoil looks like, you know, silver gelatin, they're kind of familiar with it. You know, once you mention Ansel Adams' name, then mm-hmm. they call, yeah. And so, and then you can see the comparison. Well, see, now over here, we did it as silver. Over here is the same negative, but we did it as a platinum. And they're like, oh my God, it's two different prints. Yeah, two different feelings. That is why to show it is really as important, if not more important, than how you captured it in a way, you know, because you can do so much. The paper sets the mood. So definitely you have to be able to show the work like that.
Tell me, I'm really curious now about the many different sort of braided artistic processes that are going on, because there's the pre-shot planning, there's the in the field, you know, gauging the light, finalizing the composition, there's the darkroom activity and the scanning. But now when you're taking the negative, whatever form that might be in, and putting it on paper.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an act of making, it's its own art, of choosing paper, of choosing, yeah. You know, this kind of stuff. What kind of aesthetics go into this? I mean, you talk about working with printers' styles.
Yeah. Right. Collaboration. And you really seek out those printers who are really good at what they do. Then you go there and you have to be there when you're doing that first initial print. You know, so you can get it, because even, you know, you can send back and forth in the mail, and it just takes forever to do that. If you're there, you know, most printer can get you 90% of where they think it should go. It's that last 5% to where it really sets who you are and how you print it your specific way. And so you work with these printers who are really good. You know, they've been working, you know, minimum 10 years, 15, 20, 30 years, you know, at that craft, you know, and that specialty. And that is what's going to always separate you from the guy who sends it off to quickprint.com or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And so, and the other thing is that you get the style and influence also of that printer and with your vision too, because, you know, they're putting so much effort into that print and what they know, that paper and that process, how, where they can take it. I've never had one person who's taken the negative, and the negatives don't work, but a specific way in a framework for only their print, that same negative would be changed to make it another kind of printing process. So I might have one negative that there's five ways to print it. And every one of them, the tones, the curves, the adjustments, all that are all totally different.
How do you talk to a printer? Because, I mean, you, if you walk in, you say, okay, you know, I've got this image.
Yeah.
And I want it to, what?
Okay, so what I'll do sometimes now is, it's kind of funny. I'll go as far as I'm fully capable in Lightroom or something. They go, and then it's like, well, Scott, this is the direction I want to go. And they go, and then it's always, okay. Well, let's, okay. So I think I know where you're going. And plus, having worked with these guys now, some of them for like 21 years, right? Mm-hmm. They pretty much know my, my style, but they're always very nice and very patient. And they go, yeah, okay, well, maybe we might want to do this. And then you just end up, you know, okay, let's try this. Let's open this up a little bit. We'll do a proof. You know, we'll take the proof, look at it later. No, we got to change this over here. Let's take these values up over here. And we just work together, you know. And I have an old friend. I have a very good friend of mine, Jen Freehill. She works for a lab down in, and it used to be Photograph. It's a new lab now in Colorado. And she would laugh. She goes, you know, David, anymore, I don't think of you so much as a photographer, although you are, as a director.
Right.
Because you just, you know, you have to go and specifically various types of printing. So you have to direct the printers how to get it there, you know. So, and then, but still try and maintain your style. Yeah. So that's really a lot of fun. It really, and in fact, is I enjoy that in many ways more than the really? Actual taking the photograph. Yeah, because it's not so much, you know. I mean, you've done that so many. It'd kind of be like a person who sings live all the time. You know, after a while, you're like, okay, the travel and getting up, doing all this, or working in the studio, going, wow, this is cool. I can kind of play with this. Let's do this. How's that sound? Oh no. Let's move this the tenor on this higher notes over here. It's kind of fun, you know.
It is, and you know, most of my work is street style, so I absolutely love being out there. But boy, I love the more relaxed, you know. Okay, let's look at these. Let's play with them.
Yeah.
They are separate but braided creative processes, I think. David, walk me through beginning to end to beginning through developing through display of an image or two here. I'm looking at your silver gelatin gallery right now, and a couple that really speak to me because I've either been there or, you know, I live in western Minnesota up in the Dakota border, so the cold and the snow is you know, second nature for me too. But two that really speak to me are Layers of Silence and then 22 Below. Pick one of those and beginning, middle, and end.
Okay, so Layers of Silence, I believe it was about 21 below that morning, okay? Mm-hmm. And I went out. I was on my way to see a framer to pick up some work, and it was, you know, that morning was just magical there at Oxbow Bend. I set up the camera, and I had a wooden oak tripod. And I remember I kind of pretty much all set up, and I was getting ready.
Which camera is this?
8x10 Wizard. Okay. I think it was in 2001 or 2002 when I shot that. Yeah.
Okay.
So I had it on. I was getting ready to put the film in, but I just retightened the legs a little bit more. And as I retightened the leg, I cracked one of the legs.
Oh.
And I'm like, oh, shit. So I threw the film holder in real quick, tried to, you know, and then I got off one shot. And then, of course, the camera starts going. So I got the one shot and sent it off, got it. And that was, and actually that shot originally was shot on Velvia.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So I sent it off the lab, said, God, I hope this worked. And they said, yeah, it's fine. It's great. You know? And so, you know, I looked at it. It was mainly just pink, early morning earth shadow rise. And then, you know, the color of the snow is, you know, kind of a light blue, you know, because it was that early morning. Mm-hmm. And we attempted to make it a color image, but it was a big flop because people say it just made them feel cold. So we ended up converting it over to black and white. People from Houston, I like, that's an air conditioner for you folks, you know. But anyway, we ended up making it that way. But so we did that as a silver print. Yeah. So I went down to the lab, and which was in Flagstaff, spent, so, you know, it's like 850 miles. Mm-hmm. Spent about 4 days proofing that, getting it all ready. And then
how do you spend 4 days proofing one print?
Well, because with a silver, you get the negative to where you think it is, and then you do a print, and then you wait overnight. It dries. You look at it, and then you go, because you got to wait for it to dry, you know. And then you go, oh, no, we're going to have to do, let's work on this. And then you do it the second day.
Okay.
And it's maybe you're lucky if you get it that day. If not, then you got to do it the third day, you know. And then once it's down, then you've got to try and mount it. Well, good luck on a big print that's 50 inches, you know. You know, invariably the mounting process, some of the gelatin's going to crack, like come into the print or something, and then you're like, oh shit, now we got to start all over again. So let's print another one. So we'd usually print. I remember we had a ratio early on where we'd print about 8 prints to get one or two that would actually, after mounting and everything. So, they'll really take some time. Some of these prints will just take forever, dodging and burning and all that kind of stuff too in the room. So, and then of course, then I drive back to Jackson and you wait 2 months to get it framed because the framers are so booked up. So if I want to put something up on display in September and it's a analog print, then I have to have it at the printers by June.
Wow.
How much time that goes into it. So we have a running joke in the gallery. Somebody walks in and say, I want to buy that one off the wall in June. You go, no way. No way. I need it up for the summer. Like, well, I don't care. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna buy it. Well, sorry then, you know, because you know, if I sell it off the wall, there's no more sales for this, especially if it's a popular print. It's like, there's just no way I can do it. You know, just no way. So we have to be very, very careful about that. So yeah, you're looking at 3 to 4 months to get it up on the wall. Yeah.
Very different than I took a picture 20 minutes ago and I've already got 200 likes on Instagram.
Oh, God. Yeah. And how many of those likes are going to buy anything? Yeah.
Not a one. But okay, wonderful.
200, I'm happy for you. If I get 200, I feel, wow, that's amazing. You know? And then I can watch some people take a picture of a fork and they've got 20,000. I'm going, it's just a fork. What the hell? What's this? Yeah. No, I'm not too good on social media. I don't do it enough, you know, either. You're supposed to do it like every day and all that kind of stuff. And
yep.
Yeah, I am too busy with that. You know, it's
you and me both, Ben. Now, okay, wonderful segue into the last topic here. And you decided to open a gallery. You know, March 2001, you moved to Jackson. May, 2 months later, you've decided to. First of all, why in the world in this day and age did you decide to open a gallery?
Okay, so when I was in Japan. And, you know, I used to travel over the Southwest. I started noticing these galleries popping up, you know, in Springdale, you know, Utah. And there'd be some in Santa Fe. Although Santa Fe was usually, you know, quite accomplished photographers there, you know, Ansel Adams and Christopher Burkett and things like that. And then, of course, Jackson Hole always had its photographers too, but mainly wildlife, 35 millimeter. And that is one reason why in 1992, I started shooting 8x10 because my vision was someday I want to have a gallery.
Okay.
And if I'm going to have a gallery, and having looked at people's work from the States that was 8x10, I go, well, there's no competition. I mean, these guys, they can shoot all day long 35 millimeter landscapes. But if I'm going to have 8x10, there's just no competition there. So that's why I only shot 8x10 for, gosh, at least 15 years. That's all I ever shot, seems like it. And then later on, I started mixing medium format and 35 with the 8x10 too. So, and then when we took that really long trip in 1996, I think it was, or 98, I forgot, with Fujifilm, I started noticing more and more popping up. So I said, well, at least in America, there's an appetite for that. And I would love to. So my wife and I, every place we went, we thought, well, how about this place? This could be a possibility for a gallery. And then we'd go to Santa Fe, and we would go to Aspen, and we'd go to all these other various places. Mm-hmm. But I always loved Jackson because the first time I came here was in 75. It's a great place. And it was getting to be an art community. And then mm-hmm. it just exploded. I mean, when I came here in 2001, I had everything all set up to have a gallery because I'd had shows in Tokyo that Fujifilm had sponsored. So I had all a lot of the slides were already scanned. They'd already been printed pretty big, Okay. And then I had one of the printers was in Colorado. So I was pretty set up to just go. So that was my intent when I moved over here. It's like, I'm going to open up a gallery. When I got to Jackson, it took a little while to find a place, which we did. After we got that going, we were very well received. We started off very small. We were downstairs in a store.
Right.
And then we were able to take over the top half of the street level, and then we got the whole rest of it within about a year and a half, we had the downstairs and the upstairs. So it went pretty fast. It was really fast because I remember one of the printers was like, dude, you're going to have to get real busy. You got a lot of walls here to cover. I go, well, okay. So we were just scanning 8x10s that I had done. And initially mm-hmm. when I opened up the gallery in Jackson, it was pretty funny. All I had were images of the Southwest and Kyoto in Japan. I had no Teton images at all. And I'm above that. I'm not going to shoot around here. I want to show people the world, right? Well, you learn real quick that everybody's coming in going, so where are your Teton images? I want to take something back in the Tetons.
Right.
Okay, I better get something soon, So then I started shooting. About my second year here, I started shooting Teton images, which were, it was fun,
Okay, now you bring up something that is really engaging here because, yes, a lot of the people that come in, and especially corporate clients, they want a memory of what they have experienced and loved and all of that. But you also say that a gallery has to be at least 5 years ahead of whatever the trend is.
Yeah, try to be.
Well, but what does that mean and how do you do that?
Well, like, for example, back in the early 2000s, one of the persons that actually did some printing of mine said, hey, we need to start doing some platinum printing. I'm like, well, they're too tiny. He goes, you know what, though? I think there's a way that we can take some of your images, we can scan them, and I believe we can make an internegative. Well, I said, well, Kodak stopped making internegatives. You can't do that anymore. He goes, no, we can make them. We're pretty sure we can do it. And so mm-hmm. they were printing out negatives on a light jet. Well, the substance was a Fuji substance, and they were printing out these continuous tone negatives mm-hmm. on a light jet. And there was a guy in Denver, I remember his name, Hal, I forgot his last name, older guy in his 80s, and he had this great gallery in Denver, and he had like Ansel Adams and let's see, Stieglitz. He had some of Alfred Stieglitz's work, Paul Strand's work. So we were taking these platinum prints that at that time, because the papers, there weren't a lot of papers, we were taking like 11 by 24 inch platinum prints, and we'd show them to Hal, and he would look at these and goes, what are these? These are platinum prints. He goes, yeah, I know, but I want to see this camera. And we're like, well, we just want to know what do you think of them? And he's like, well, God, they're beautiful, but how are you shooting these, you know? and then the next, you know, maybe a month later, we were showing like a 30-inch one. Now he's like flabbergasted, like, what is going on here? And he would pull out this 10X loop and be looking at it. He goes, there's no dots. What is this? This is crazy. What's going on? And so we started, again, we were really pushing the boundaries on platinum plating printing. And at one time at the gallery, I think it was around 2008, I think we had the largest platinum print in the world. It was on Arches Platine paper, which I believe was, I could be wrong, but I thought it was like 30 inches by 43 before you hit the watermark. And I had done a shot in Japan on 5x7 negative, and it just fit that paper perfect. I think I had 29.5 by 41 or something like that. Mm-hmm. We really looked. I mean, we searched for a long time to see if anybody had anything that big, and we couldn't find it. And now, you know, people are doing 40 by 60 inch, you know, platinum prints that cost $16,000 to make, you know, but we were really pushing that. And then we got into going, well, okay, can we do the same thing with silver gelatins? You know, again, you know, printing them out and then doing, contact prints, because the tonal range was so amazing, which you could do off of digital cameras. Started doing that. And then we got into doing big photogravures, which was a lot of fun, you know, because again, you use that same technology, transfer that negative, which by then we were doing inkjet negatives because they were much more archival than the light jets. So light jets would burn up literally. They were unusable after one or two sessions under the UV light.
It was, okay.
So we had to switch out to a new substrate. But we started doing that. And then we had pretty big size, as big as we could get, photogravures. So, you know, that technology, just bringing it into, you know, this era, the older style kind of hybrid printing for those older styles of printing, you know? So yeah, trying to keep ahead of the curve, you know?
Yeah. Oh my God, I'm as envious as I'll get out here. It strikes me though, I mean, here you have meticulous artistry, you know, much in the same line that you would look at the brushstrokes of a painter or the work of a sculptor. Does that play when somebody walks into the gallery and you say, do you know what you're looking at?
Yeah, it does. It does.
Okay.
Well, because the person who collectors never ask those questions about sharpness or anything like that, but they can see the fidelity of the print, you know, an 8x10 print. Or I have one print in here that it's one of my favorite silver gelatins. It's called the Reason Why, WY, you know, and okay. I shot that. I shot it with a Nikon, but I had a Zeiss Apple Sonar lens 135, and I literally did three rows, and they were six shots to a row. Okay, so 18. I think I shot it with the D800E or something. Because if you look at the print, you can see these clouds are streaming off the print, off the peaks. Wind was out of the north. Beautiful clouds coming off of it. And there was no way I could get that with an 8x10. It was just, it was happening so fast, setting it up. And then I knew that if I shot it with an 8x10, I was going to have to crop it because it had to be a panorama. So I pulled out the 800E, put this Apple Sonar on, you know, Zeiss quality, and just went bam, 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 bam. And then came down again, 6, 6, 6. It took 2 years to find the technology to put it together, because one, the top left-hand corner, there was no mountain or ground or anything to, you know, for it to attach to. It was just cloud material. Mm-hmm. Nobody could stitch it together. And one day a buddy of mine who was a photographer came in town. I said, I got this great image, but damn it, I can't get the top left-hand corner. And that means the top row is going to have to be cropped out. Look at that. It just doesn't work. And he goes, PT GUI. I go, what's that? He goes, it's great software. Yeah, just PT GUI. And I remember during the time he was in the gallery, I had called the lab in Flagstaff. I said, you ever heard of P.T. Gooey? They went, yeah, we've heard about that. And I go, here's my credit card number. Buy it. See if you can put that image together. They did it in less than 30 minutes. Matt called me back up. Matt Beatty at Hidden Light calls me up. He goes, done. Man, it looks awesome. I go, you've got to be kidding me. And he goes, yeah, I mean, because I've had other people, other printers, like trying. He goes, I can't even put it together. And these are people who have been working in Photoshop for 20 plus years, right? I can't get that last stitch to look good. P.T. Gooey, bam. And we have made a lot of money off that image. The fact is, we've got only got two left. And the one in the gallery now is going for a lot of money. So I'm like, yeah, you know, and I think it's sold. But we'll see. Anyway, it's best. And my friend Frank, he later on, he passed away, he had a heart condition. And I was so sad because it was all, you know, Frank helped out so much, you know, that one. Just one little remark, P.T. Gooey. Yeah, no, not a problem, buddy. You know, so,
yeah. You know, away we go.
Yeah. Yeah.
David, this has been inspiring and wonderful. I've enjoyed every minute of this. Thank you very much.
Well, yeah, sure. You bet. And stay in touch. Come up and see us sometime.
You know, I am in Jackson every now and then. I'm going to knock on your door sometime this year.
Okay. All right.
Take care, man. Talk to you later.
Frames. Because excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit us at www.readframes.com.